much. It's a pleasure today to have Dr. Andy Racine with us, and I will introduce him formally in just a few minutes. But top of mind, we are now several months removed from the first surge of COVID-19 in the New York City area. However, there are some disturbing trends, certainly nationally, but also locally. We've seen an uptick in the number of positive tests in our emergency departments and the Montefiore Health System, and this usually precedes an increase in admissions as well as complications of COVID-19. In addition, in New York City and New York State, there's been an increase in the number of positive tests or percent positive tests, as well as increase in hospital admissions. So it's important that we remain vigilant, and I believe we are prepared for the worst, but hoping for the best, and Dr. Racine will probably be able to address some of this for us as well. And I just want to remind everybody that if you have not done so already, to make sure you get a flu shot. So we have been busy at Einstein and Montefiore. We've been hard at work trying to understand this virus and to develop new techniques and new treatments. In fact, we've developed a unique and novel antibody test that's been approved by the New York State Department of Health and is in use in our health system. We've also developed new therapies, including bifunctional antibodies, specific types of antibodies that are teed up to be used in therapeutic trials and may be more effective than standard monoclonal antibodies. At Einstein, we developed a unique antiviral agent that blocks the ability of the virus to copy itself, and it's currently being used in therapeutic trials outside of the United States. And of course, at Montefiore and at Einstein, we have been leaders in the use of convalescent plasma to treat patients with COVID-19. So a lot of this was really made possible by the support of the folks who are supporters of ours, and we thank you for that. And that's resulted in fact, our most productive year in terms of NIH research between Einstein and Montefiore, over $220 million of NIH funding in the course of calendar year 2020. That's about a 25% increase over 2019. Some of it certainly directed towards COVID-19. There have been a couple of highlights in the lay press as well that I will draw your attention to. At the end of September, Dr. Betsy Harold, who's the Vice Chair for Research in Pediatrics, was highlighted in an article called How Do Children Fight Off Coronavirus, where she talked about the difference in the immune responses of children versus adults to this disease. A couple weeks later, Dr. Kartik Chandran, who's our director of viral pandemic disease, was highlighted. His lab was highlighted in a piece in the New York Times called The Race for a Super Antibody Against Coronavirus. And my classmate, Lizan Porosky, was highlighted in a New Yorker article around the same time, entitled, It Will Take More Than a Vaccine to Beat COVID-19. So I'm incredibly gratified and exceptionally proud of the work that we've done at Einstein and Montefiore during what has been a really an amazingly difficult year. To talk a little bit about that year and what we can anticipate ahead, it's a delight for me to have Dr. Andy Racine, who's the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for the Montefiore Health System. He's also a professor of pediatrics at Einstein and has been, you know, part of our faculty since 1992 and is responsible for a whole lot of things at Montefiore, including quality and safety, medical affairs, graduate medical education, and the Montefiore Medical Group. Andy is incredibly accomplished. He holds combined doctorates in medicine and economics and has been one of the leaders that have actually led us through this this pandemic in such a way that we hold our heads proud at what we've been able to accomplish. So, Andy, thank you very much for joining us today, and I'll pass the baton to you.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Dean Tomaselli, for inviting me, and also Pam for inviting me. This is an exciting moment to be able to share some of this information with the folks on the call, and I also do have to sort of credit a lot of the work that Dean Tomaselli has outlined as coming out of an environment that he is the leader of. So a lot of the abilities of folks at the faculty level, both on the clinical side and in the basic science side, comes from the sort of environment that Dean Tomaselli has been able to create and nurture and foster during the course of his tenure here. So that's really, a lot of the credit goes to him as well. And I just want to acknowledge that before we begin the conversation. There's a lot, as Dean Tomaselli said, that's been going on since what were really very harrowing days for us, actually, back in March and April and into May, when we were first exposed to this virus as an academic health center. We have taken on the responsibility of confronting this virus the way we do for a lot of things. We have sort of, if you will, multiple hats that we wear in trying to get our arms around this problem. One of them is simply to deliver care to the population of people who come to us who are sick. And that took precedence over just about everything in those early days because the numbers of people were just so extraordinary and they were coming to us at such a high rate with such a great degree of difficult clinical portraits that we really had everything we could do simply to keep up with the demand for care. But in addition to that, as Dean Tomaselli said, we are an academic medical center, and one of our most important virtues is that we are responsible for trying to figure out things when we get a brand new clinical condition that presents itself. And a lot of the science that we now know about this virus can trace its roots back to the work that's been done here at Einstein and at Montefiore. And then the final thing that we also do is we prepare the next generation of physicians and practitioners to be able to function in almost any kind of an environment. And there is, we've talked about this with the medical students and the residents who have been living through this with us, that there will be nothing else in the course of their entire careers that will be nearly as impactful on them as the months that they have lived through during the past 9 months. It is something that from the standpoint of the formation of a physician can't really be replicated, and will, just as those of us who grew up during the early days of the HIV epidemic and people who have been experiencing this in other historical eras know, there's something that happens to you during the course of your training when you experience it in the midst of a crisis like this that becomes indelible for you the rest of your professional career. So to all of those things, I think we have a lot to be proud of, but also a lot to fall back on in terms of how we're planning for what's going to be coming down the pike in the next several months.
Terrific. Andy, maybe you can explain to us what your feeling is about the intersection between flu season that's approaching us and the current pandemic, and how flu season might be different this year, and how it might influence the trajectory of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Sure, that is a very important question, and it's something that all of us in the Northern Hemisphere are deeply concerned about. We know what it's like during a normal flu season in hospitals such as Montefiore, where there are floods of both children and adults who come into our hospital needing extraordinary care, because influenza itself can be a very serious illness for people. And because it presents in ways that are very similar to COVID, we are concerned about what things are going to be like. But it is worth sort of trying to distinguish, to the extent that we can, what differs between these two diseases and what we think we may be able to anticipate going forward. So we can talk about the viruses themselves. These are both respiratory viruses, and the symptoms that they present with are very, very similar. There's an enormous amount of overlap between what a patient who comes with influenza looks like to a medical system and what a patient with COVID looks like. So in both of these conditions, people present with fever, with cough, with headache, with body aches, with generalized sort of malaise, and to a certain extent with gastrointestinal symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea. So those things are the same in both conditions. There is something that's a little bit unusual about COVID and its presentation, and that is that a fair percentage of patients with this condition present with what's called in medical terminology anosmia, meaning that they lose their sense of taste and smell. That's not something that we traditionally see with influenza patients, but it is something that people who have had COVID have reported with a great degree of frequency. So that tends to be something that's a little different. That's just in terms of how people present. It is true that some folks go on in both of these conditions to have complications from those initial presentations. So whether you have COVID or you have influenza, you can end up with pneumonia. People can end up with complications in terms of the functioning of their hearts, in terms of the functioning of their kidneys. People can get septic. People can get infections with other things. Both of those kinds of things can happen with each of these illnesses. But having said that, we do know that the likelihood of getting severely ill is greater with COVID than it is with influenza. COVID is a much more serious condition in that regard. It also has some differences with respect to how it presents, in the sense that you can have COVID and not really be symptomatic for many days. And some people never get symptoms with it. That is also somewhat true of influenza, but less so. People tend to get symptomatic much more quickly when they catch flu than they do when they catch COVID. And the likelihood of being completely asymptomatic with influenza is less. The final thing that I would say about it is that children tend to be affected much more greatly with flu than with COVID. There's been a lot in the literature about the fact that, for better or for worse, and as a pediatrician, I'm going to say for better, COVID doesn't seem to affect children quite as severely as it does adults, particularly older adults. Having said that, everyone I'm sure has been hearing about this particular kind of syndrome that does occur in a very, very small number of children with COVID. That is a very severe manifestation of an inflammatory response, but we don't see that normally. Whereas many children who get influenza, particularly young children, children less than a year of age, less than 6 months of age, they can actually get quite sick with flu. And we see a lot of them in the hospital relative to the numbers of children that we see with COVID. So the other thing that's really important in terms of a difference, aside from how these viruses present and what they look like, is what we can do about them. And as Dean Tomaselli was quick to point out in the introduction to all of this, and I'm going to reinforce, we have right now a very effective vaccine for influenza. And by very effective, I mean in a good year, it can be 50 or 60% effective, which is really not bad at all. And that can protect people completely, some of them, but even people who aren't completely protected, if you have gotten your flu shot, you end up getting flu, tends to be a much milder case than if you hadn't had your influenza vaccine. So that's one thing that's different. The other thing that's different is we have a fairly effective antiviral agents, against flu, so that if someone is diagnosed early with influenza and they're given Tamiflu, that really tends to lessen the course of their condition and shorten the amount of time that they're going to be sick. There are treatments that we do have for COVID. They're not quite as effective or in the same league right now as Tamiflu is for influenza. But the hope is, and Dean Tomaselli referenced some of this, the hope is that as things develop over time, not only are we going to have an effective vaccine, or maybe more than one effective vaccine, but also that we'll have other kinds of treatments, either convalescent plasma, monoclonal antibodies. There are people that are talking about other kinds of inhaled or sprays that can be used that may be able to interfere with the transmission of this virus. It's important to remember, influenza has been around for centuries. COVID is a brand new virus. We are maybe a year into our experience with this virus, and the amount that we have learned about it in such a short period of time is nothing short of astonishing. medicine, and it's something that will be written about for generations, I'm sure.
So, great. Dr. Racine, I had another question. We are perhaps on the precipice, we hope, of having a vaccine that might be effective. And I had a couple of questions about that. One, there have been approaches to try and, in a general way, enhance the immune system. Is there any suggestion that, in fact, doing this, even with like a flu vaccine, might somehow prime our immune systems to make us a little bit better equipped, for example, handle COVID-19? That's one question. And the second is, what are the plans for deploying such a vaccine when it becomes available, not only in our health system, but more broadly?
So I just want to make sure, Dean Tomaselli, that I heard the first part of the question. The question was, will the vaccine help? Was the question about the COVID vaccine or about the flu vaccine?
And I it was about the COVID vaccine, but people have suggested that, in fact, priming our immune system, maybe with another vaccine, could, in theory, help us fight off COVID-19. Do you think there's any chance that that might happen? In fact, there have been other therapies, BCG and other things that have been suggested that might be useful. So I guess the real question is the interaction between flu vaccination and when it becomes available, a vaccine against COVID-19, if there is any. And then
Right. Now I understand better. Thank you for that.
Sure.
So, you know, the immune system is quite a, as you know, a very complex and intricate part of our physiology. And it is nothing short of remarkable how it works. I mean, we are daily exposed to all kinds of proteins in our environment that the human body has to be able to recognize as being foreign. And our ability to do that depends upon a repertoire of immune cells in our body that can recognize these different kinds of proteins and react to them in a relatively short amount of time, and then multiply that reaction when it's necessary in order to protect us against infection. What we know about this COVID virus currently, which is both interesting and somewhat reassuring, is that the way it works is that on the surface of this virus are a series of different kinds of proteins, but only one of which seems to be the most important with respect to the ability of the virus to infect human cells. And that protein we've referred to as a spike protein, simply because when you look at these viruses under an electron microscope, these proteins stick out from the surface of the cell like spikes. And so these spike proteins are the element of the virus that attaches to human cells and allows the virus to get inside the cell, infect the virus, and take over the virus's genetic mechanisms for making the cell's mechanisms for making more virus. That's important because what it means is almost no matter what kind of immunologically based attack that we are designing against this virus, all of them are targeted against this spike protein. Because if you can interfere with that spike protein's ability to attach to a human cell, you interrupt the infection and you prevent it from actually multiplying inside the body. So how does that work? Well, the spike protein itself is a very large molecule, and there's only a certain part of it that actually attaches to a receptor on the human cell. That's called a receptor binding domain. If you can get an antibody that looks at that domain and interferes with it, you're doing very well. So the way all of these different vaccines are designed to work is either they inject that spike protein directly into a person so that the person makes antibodies to the spike protein, and then when a virus comes along, it recognizes the spike protein, interferes with it, or other vaccines co-opt human cells into making spike proteins themselves. And so the cells in our bodies become factories for making spike proteins that can then be recognized by the body. And so the body will be prepared when an actual spike protein on a virus ends up coming into the body. That's also true of these monoclonal antibodies. They are simply antibodies to this spike protein. The reason why I say this is somewhat helpful is that it looks like this virus is heavily dependent on the spike protein, because the spike protein doesn't change as the virus mutates over time. It's simply conserved. And so a virus that stays the same over time is an easier target for us to develop a vaccine toward. The reason why we have to get a new vaccine for flu every year is that the surface proteins of the flu mutate. And so every year we have new proteins that we have to develop new vaccines for. That's not true, so far as we know up until now, of the COVID virus. COVID virus spike protein is the same and doesn't seem to change. So if we get a vaccine that targets that spike protein, it should work for some period of time, and we may not need to constantly be inventing new vaccines. Now, the question as to whether being vaccinated with vaccines for other viruses protect against COVID, the likelihood that that's the case is small, because, as I had said, you need to be able to interfere with this very specific kind of protein on the COVID virus in order to be effective. And the antibodies that we produce when we're vaccinated, for example, against flu or against measles or against chickenpox, those antibodies do not actually adhere to that spike protein. Now, there is some speculation that there are other parts of the immune system that maybe are being stimulated by vaccinations in general. There are these white blood cells called T cells, and maybe if we're stimulating them for other reasons, they're just sort of at a heightened sense of alert. We don't know that for sure, and there's a lot of research that's being conducted now, as you had alluded to, Dean Tomaselli, with regard to BCG, other kinds of vaccines. But up until now, we don't have really solid evidence that that's the case.
Now,
I was going to say there are several different kinds of vaccines that are coming down the pike in rapid succession with regard to the COVID virus in particular. The first one that people, I'm sure, have heard about is this vaccine that's being developed by Pfizer, an American company, in conjunction with a German company called BioNTech. That vaccine, people think, is going to be available in small amounts maybe by the end of this calendar year and by the first quarter of next year in much larger amounts for a more general distribution in the population. But that's only the first one. Probably close on the heels of that one will be another one developed by an American company called Moderna, which is working in conjunction with the Swiss company AstraZeneca. And that has a vaccine that's in development that's very similar to this Pfizer vaccine. And we'll probably be seeing that early in the next year. And then there are several others as well. So what we're going to be seeing by the middle of 2021, certainly toward the end of 2021, is probably a series of different vaccines, all of which are targeting the same target, but in different ways. And we will see as they get introduced and as we learn more about the phase 3 trials for each of these vaccines, what their various levels of efficiency are, so that we'll be able to determine which are the best ones to use.
Terrific. Perhaps you can just let us know how we plan on deploying these vaccines when they become available.
Sure. And that's another great question. So Monosure, I have to say, is very well positioned to do this. And the reason I say that is that we have a very large ambulatory footprint in the Bronx and Lower Westchester, and even up into the Hudson Valley, that already delivers vaccines all the time, right? And you're talking to someone who spent most of his career doing exactly that as a pediatrician working in one of the practices in the Bronx. I would deliver vaccines on a daily basis. So we have both the storage facilities for them, the vaccine, you know, capability to deliver it, the way to sort of monitor the effects of it, to report the administration of it, all of those things. It's a little different about the vaccine that's coming down the pike is a couple of things. One is it's going to be in very, very short supply to begin with. And the only people who are going to be eligible to get it initially are going to be frontline healthcare workers. And that means people working in an ICU or an emergency department, folks like that. The other thing that's a little bit special about this vaccine is it has to be stored in a very, very cold environment. It has to be stored at minus 70 degrees centigrade, which is a very, very cold, like dry ice, if you will. And you cannot just keep it in a regular refrigerator the way we do normal vaccines, because if you do, you can only, it'll only last for a certain period of time and then you have to deliver it. So we have some logistical wrinkles with regard to where we're going to store it and how we're going to distribute it around and keep it cold right up to the point where we reconstitute it and give it to somebody. But we'll work those things out. Currently, we have elaborate plans for it now so that even if we were to get a shipment of the vaccine next week, we can already know how we're going to distribute it and in what sequence. But that's only the first stage of this. And as it gets further and further along, we're going to have larger and larger numbers of sites in which the vaccine will be deliverable. So we are well prepared for each of the phases of vaccine delivery as more and more supply of the vaccine comes online.
Well, that's absolutely terrific and great to hear. And I want to thank Dr. Racine for a really terrific conversation today. A lot of new and important insights regarding COVID-19. And I think we'll wrap up by thanking everybody who attended today. And thank you for your support, and have a great weekend. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.